There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, and welcome to the Queens of England podcast. Chat the Six Wives with Elizabeth Norton. I imagine you've all been waiting with bated breath to hear about my cycle ride. Well, it went really well. Being England, the weather forecast was super sketchy, expecting to have rain at any moment, but in the end it all...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All held off, and it was a lovely sunny-ish day. I set off along with about 35,000 other people, some doing the 100-mile challenge, others doing the 46-miler with me. I was aiming to do it in around 3.5 hours, but it is amazing how much faster you go when you don't have to stop for lights or traffic or anything like that. Even going into enemy territory, i.e. Surrey, went well, and in the end I did the whole thing in a shade under 3 hours. But, of course, the ride aspect was only part of this whole project, because I was raising money, as you know, for the British Red Cross and their UK Solidarity Appeal. Thanks in part to generous donations from a few listeners, I made my target of raising £500, that's just over $650 to my American fans. The Just Giving page is still open for a little longer, so if any of you would like to donate to that, then there is still time. Turns out I am a part-time podcaster, full-time athlete. The all-important address again is justgiving.com/fundraising/JamesBolton17. I would also like to thank my most recent Patreon donators, Shannon, Jenny, and Benjamin, as well as all of my existing bands of brothers and sisters. Head over to patreon.com/Queens of England Podcast to find out more about supporting this show. Finally, I would like to quickly let you know about what episodes I have planned out, as a few of you have been asking me on social media and by email. I am nothing if not a stubborn man who likes to stick to the rules. Kinda. So we are sticking to only covering the Queen's Consort of England. That means that after Catherine Parr, we have to bridge a gap of over 50 years until we have another Queen Consort of England, and that is as part of a different royal house, the Stuarts. But, of course, I couldn't leave you hanging like that. That would be cruel. Therefore, I have some supplementals planned. First, we're going to look at Philip of Spain, the husband of England's first undisputed Queen Regnant, Mary I. We have spent quite a bit of time already with Mary, but the tumult in her life is far from over. In the episode, we will examine what differences were when a ruling queen married rather than a king, and what happened when Mary tried to foist an unwilling husband onto an unwelcoming realm. After that, we will move on to her sister, Elizabeth. She is famed, of course, as being the Virgin Queen, but this all did not prevent her from having quite a bit of man drama, with suitors and favourites popping up across her 4 decades on the throne. Once we're done with that, I'm going to take what I believe to be a well-deserved week off, before we dive in headlong into the third, and I'm afraid, final season of the Queens of England podcast, The Stuarts. Okay, so on with the show. This is the third of my chat episodes, the others being with Heather Tesco of the Renaissance English History podcast and Claire Ridgway of the Anne Boleyn Files. Those two were laser-focused on just one of Henry's queens each, but today we're going to be examining them all. For that, we need a proper Tudor expert, someone who has written on every one of the wives of Henry VIII. And luckily, I have found just the woman. Elizabeth Norton is a British historian who largely focuses on the Tudor period. I'm very familiar with her books personally, and many of them have been part of my research from many episodes down this podcast's run. In particular, she wrote one of my two Bibles, books that cover every single English queen, no matter how obscure. That was called England's Queens, and believe me, when you are writing about some of the really obscure medieval queens, that book was a godsend. She's also written biographies of 4 of Henry's wives, and those of you who have listened to my guest episode on the Renaissance English History podcast about Bessie Blount will have heard me quote from her book on Henry's mistress as well. In summary, she is the perfect guest for this show, and I started by asking her just why Henry had so many wives.
So Henry VIII is obviously England's most married monarch. Apart from the Anglo-Saxons, where some of those kings had 3 wives, he beats the other post-conquest totals by 4 wives. Primarily I would say it was children, the reason why Henry VIII married so many times. It's not the only reason. He's quite unusual amongst kings in general in that period, in that he tended to marry the women that would have been his mistress. So Francis II of France, for example, was married first of all to a French princess and then an Austrian princess. He had plenty of mistresses, but he didn't marry them, and that he never would have married them. So Henry VIII is unusual in that respect, and I think partly it's because he could choose to marry whom he wanted to. He got into the habit of marrying for love, effectively. He thought that he was in love with Catherine of Aragon at the wedding. He'd known her since childhood. Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, of course, were chosen for love. The Anne of Cleves marriage went so horribly wrong, mainly because Henry hadn't met her before the wedding. Then Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr, again, were women that he'd known and decided that he was in love with. So I think he personally was almost spoilt for choice, really. He would marry a woman that he found attractive and then someone else.
Yeah, I definitely get that feeling. You're going through all the medieval kings and things. You do get sort of drilled into you, particularly at university, that it's very much all a very cold sort of contractual thing, and you're told to disregard any thoughts of love. You know, love is irrelevant. And with Henry, it's love, or I almost think it's more the idea of love that fascinated him. He seems to almost persuade himself into these sort of situations, because it's the sort of the chivalric, the Arthurian thing to do, to find this damsel and make her a queen. And he also seems to, for someone who seems to have quite a thin skin, he seems to love to find women who disagreed with him or challenged him, but never quite got on board with that once they became a queen. It was something that was very fascinating in the chase, but not so wonderful on the throne. Anne Boleyn's obviously the great example of that one.
Yeah, I mean, Henry VIII was certainly a romantic and would have seen himself as a romantic at heart. He liked being in love and he wanted to be in love with his wife, something which his European counterparts found quite strange. Even Anne of Cleves, which is his most diplomatic marriage, he hadn't met her before the wedding. He married her because he wanted an alliance with her brother. He still convinced himself that he was in love with her. He had a portrait painted. He arranged her household. He arranged everything. And he even looked into ways that he could please her as a husband. So he looked into German custom to ensure that she was happy and would learn to love him in turn. So he had a romantic notion of love, even with a woman that he'd never met. It's very much based in courtly love, which is obviously the medieval tradition of knights wooing a higher status lady often. It's quite a chaste love. Henry had this idea with Anne of Cleves that he would visit her in disguise, and she would, because of the love between them, because they were betrothed, she would immediately recognise him and fall into his arms. Of course, it didn't happen like that. He arrived to meet Anne of Cleves at Rochester. She completely ignored him. She didn't know who he was. When he finally threw off his disguise and declared that he was the king, she obviously then bowed before him and they spoke together. But for him, the illusion had been shattered because she hadn't recognised him. He actually should have known from royal precedent it wasn't necessarily a good idea. His great-uncle, Henry VI, had visited his betrothed wife dressed as a squire carrying a letter from the king. And Margaret Anjou, his fiancée, kept him on his knees the entire time and completely ignored him. So it's not a very happy precedent. But, I mean, in general, Henry had a very eclectic taste in women. So, I mean, Anne Boleyn is very different to Jane Seymour. Jane Seymour is very different to the next English wife, Catherine Howard. You couldn't always pinpoint what Henry's type would be. So you get the fiery Anne Boleyn who disagreed with him. You get the more demure Jane Seymour, as far as we can tell. You then get Catherine Howard, who seems fairly uninterested in politics. So he's very eclectic. You can't really put your finger on what necessarily made Henry VIII choose a woman to be his wife.
No, I think that I find that completely fascinating. A slightly sort of to turn the question around a little bit, I had a question from, and I'm going to mangle the pronunciation of this person's name. I think it's pronounced Linos. Who asked, her main focus was actually on Jane Seymour and why did she marry Henry after what had happened to Anne Boleyn? And I think I'd sort of make it into a more general question of, so we focus why Henry married these women, but why did these women agree, or to the extent that they were allowed to agree, to marry him? The famous story I loved finding out was, we're not sure if it's true, but when Henry was trying to marry Christina of Denmark before he ended up marrying Anne of Cleves, she said, "I would marry him if I had two heads." What was the attraction of marrying? What was the attraction? He was the king, but to what extent do you think it was their will to marry him, and how much of it was a forced?
I think it's quite varied about the reasons for the wives marrying Henry. Catherine of Aragon, his first wife, she'd known him since childhood. She'd been betrothed to him since the death of his brother Arthur, her husband. So she always thought it was her destiny to be Queen of England and to marry Henry. So, I mean, for her, there was not really, she would never have turned down Henry. He was also young and attractive at that point. She probably was in love with him. Anne Boleyn, of course, the attraction may well have been in Henry himself. Again, he was still young. He was the most handsome prince in Europe, according to accounts. One account said that he would make a pretty woman. for example, he's very handsome, very athletic. So that may be part of the attraction for Anne Boleyn. We know that Anne was trying to make an advantageous marriage as well. She tried to marry the heir to the Earl of Northumberland first, and then obviously Henry VIII was the best match in the kingdom. So partly political, partly possibly attraction with Anne Boleyn. Jane Seymour. Jane Seymour may well have considered becoming Henry's mistress, but obviously when Anne Boleyn had a miscarriage early in 1536, it changed everything effectively. It meant that there was a possible vacancy for a new queen, and Jane rose to fill it. When Jane agreed to become Henry's wife, Anne Boleyn hadn't yet been executed or even arrested. We know from sources that Henry and Jane had promised to marry each other before Anne's arrest. So it probably came as a surprise to Jane quite how brutal Henry was in what he did to Anne Boleyn. It was unheard of for a king to execute his wife. It never happened in England before. So Jane, I think we can say that Jane didn't necessarily know that Anne was going to be beheaded. It probably would have put her off, I would think. We know later on during the Pilgrimage of Grace, which is a rebellion against Henry VIII, Jane Seymour actually tried to speak out for the rebels, and Henry told her to hold her tongue and reminded her of the fate of Anne Boleyn. Chapuy, the imperial ambassador, says that that is enough to frighten a woman who's not very secure. So it seems quite likely that Jane agreed to marry Henry before she knew that he was going to kill his wife effectively, and after that was rather kept in line through fear. Anne of Cleves had no choice in marriage to Henry. She was a diplomatic bride. Her brother told her she was marrying Henry, and off she went. We do know that she, from the German sources, the letters of the ambassador from Cleves, Karl Haas, make it clear that she didn't want to be divorced from Henry. And later on, she sought remarriage with him and considered herself to be his true wife. So it was very shameful for Anne for her marriage to be annulled. So it seems likely that she did cling on to the idea of her marriage to Henry. Catherine Howard, he was the king. I think that's as far as we can go. She clearly wasn't in love with him. He was very overweight by that stage, in very poor health, and she was a young teenage girl. I think it's pretty clear that she married him because he was king, and that made her queen, and she got given jewels and dresses. Catherine Parr didn't want to marry Henry VIII. There's a source that says that she said she preferred to be his mistress when he proposed. We also have a poem written by Henry when he was courting Catherine, in which he's attempting to persuade her to marry him. She wanted to marry Thomas Seymour, but he couldn't really turn down the king. So I think it's a bit of a mixture, really. I think in general, his position as king meant it was impossible for a woman to turn him down. And mostly a woman wouldn't turn him down, even if they knew what had happened to the previous wives. Obviously, Christina of Denmark did apparently make the remark saying if she had two heads, one would be at the King of England's disposal.
I agree. It's interesting that it is a mix of forced or semi-forced and choice. I don't know that many of them really had much of an option, in the sense that, you know, once the king asks you, you have to say yes. I think Anne Boleyn is possibly the greatest example of she kind of engineered the situation
You can see the pressure that she's under from Henry VIII's love letters, which survived. So I mean, it was tricky for her. I mean, he was married, and she retreated home to Hever Castle, but she was bombarded with letters, and it's clear that he wasn't going away.
I did a little supplemental reading out all of those letters, and some of them are particularly graphic, to say the least.
Yes. Yeah. He was very interested in Anne.
Very, very much so. So moving on a little bit from there, I was thinking we could talk about are there any sort of similarities between all six wives? I don't think there's necessarily one that sort of, you can sort of string them all and say they were all this, but I think there are definitely some similarities between groups of them. So we have some were particularly I call them difference between like traditionalists and reformers. So people like, you know, Catherine of Aragon in particular was obviously a very straight Catholic. Then you have Jane Seymour, who And I think Jane Seymour, who's kind of in the middle, even though a lot of her family was quite traditionally Catholic, it's difficult to tell because, you know, her brother ended up being, you know, a huge Protestant influence. And Catherine Parr, obviously, too. And then you have Catherine Howard and Anne of Cleves, who seem to be kind of content to just go along with whatever's going on. And you also have English queens and foreign queens. It's quite unusual in this period that we have so many English queens. In the Middle Ages, it was almost unheard of. I think it was, there was from Henry I to, I think, Elizabeth Woodville, they were all foreign. And then Henry ended up marrying four English. And then you also have sort of younger queens versus more experienced ones. Particularly Catherine Howard being the great example of the young, and maybe sort of Anne of Cleves as well, though it was not so much her age, but she was quite an inexperienced person, particularly in sort of English culture. So I was wondering if you saw any, want to expand on any of those and any other sort of similarities or trends that you see between them?
Yeah, I mean, you can certainly group the queens into sort of various groups. And, I mean, the most noteworthy thing, as you say, is the fact that four of Henry's six wives were English. In the post-conquest period, as you say, Elizabeth Woodville, the wife of Edward IV, was English. Other than that, Henry IV's first wife, who wasn't the Queen, was English. And King John's first wife, Isabella of Gloucester, who was very briefly technically Queen, but never given the title of Queen, was English. Everybody else was foreign-born. And that was the way things worked. Kings didn't marry English women. Kings married foreign princesses to arrange an alliance. And that was how it worked originally with Henry. So Catherine of Aragon, he married her partly because he wanted to get married, because he wanted to assert himself as an adult king, but he also wanted an alliance. Catherine was the daughter of Ferdinand of Aragon and his wife Isabella, Queen of Castile. So she was about the best match in Europe, other than her elder sisters. But the English queens, they could obviously bring no alliance. Henry was their king. He could do what he wanted to submit, basically. So it's interesting to see them as a group. But I think what's most striking about them as a group is that actually they're very diverse. I mean, actually, they're amongst the most diverse of Henry's wives, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Catherine Howard, Catherine Parr, which sort of brings us into other groupings. So you mentioned religious groupings. It's quite tricky to talk about religious divisions as sort of facts in Henry VIII's reign, because obviously the Reformation was only just beginning. So Anne Boleyn, we know she was interested in religious reform. We've got quite a lot of evidence for that, but you can't call her a Protestant, especially because Protestantism didn't exist at that point. The first Protestant queen is Catherine Parr, very definitely, who was obviously the last one and the one who survives into the next reign. She had the first Protestant royal funeral in 1548. But we can certainly see some as reformers and some as more traditional. So Catherine of Aragon, very much traditional. Jane Seymour, what we know of her is traditional. She attempted to intercede for the rebels in the Pilgrimage of Grace, who were Catholic or traditional rebels, trying to defend the traditional church. We also know that she attempted to save some of the nunneries from closing. Catherine Howard, probably traditional. There's nothing to indicate any interest in reform. Anne of Cleves is a bit more tricky. She was Catholic, not Protestant. A lot of people mistakenly think she was Protestant because she was a German princess and she was sent effectively as the match that the Schmalkaldic League sent, which was a Protestant defensive league. She was their alliance, the price of their alliance with Henry. But Cleves wasn't Protestant. Cleves was a Catholic state. And so Anne was Catholic, but she does seem to have conformed more or less during the religious changes. So, you know, there's nothing to indicate that she had any interest in reform, but she's certainly not steadfast in her faith during Edward's reign, for example. So again, you can group the wives, but again, they're all quite diverse in how they reacted. Again, so I do think really you have to look at them as six individual women, really, and it's difficult to be too sort of strong with looking for the similarities.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it like that, and you should. It's easy in history, I think, to sort of stop thinking of these people as humans, and start and think of them as just letters on a page or pictures in a portrait. And because I mean, just thinking about Catherine Parr, the only image I ever had of her in my head is the famous one with her in that, the big hat and the really white face. And she sort of looks very sort of that sort of matronly, nursey personality that she's so often and rather lazily given in sort of a lot of the stuff, particularly when I was learning it at school. And then you sort of look at other portraits that I've sort of come across with research in the episodes, and she suddenly looks a bit like Queen Elizabeth. She's got very beautiful. She's got this beautiful, beautiful hair, and she looks young. She wasn't old when she married Henry. From all the stories, I assume she was about his age.
No, not at all. She's not. Catherine Parr's named after Catherine of Aragon because her mother was one of Catherine of Aragon's greatest friends. So that shows the generation gap.
Yeah, he did. I mean, yeah, because he didn't. He tended to marry, aside from Catherine Howard, he seemed to always marry women around the same age. He tended to marry women in their sort of mid-20s.
No, I mean, actually, Henry VIII's tastes run more towards the older woman, effectively. I mean, they're not older than him, but he tended to marry women towards their late 20s, sometimes 30s. But Catherine Howard's a bit unusual that he went so young, because mostly the women he's interested in are at least mid-20s, which is older by the standards of the time. Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, actually makes quite a barbed comment about Jane, saying he'd be surprised if a woman could have been so long at Henry's court and still be a virgin. So, it was quite unusual that she was an unmarried woman. It suggests she was on the shelf a bit.
Well, I think it's also a sign that I think a reason for it is also the reasons why he married, because I remember when I was going through the Middle Ages and it was 12-year-old, 12, 13, 14-year-olds all the time. Some of them being married, betrothed when they were about 8. I can't remember her name. The one that married Richard
II. Isabella of Valois. Yeah. Isabella of Valois, 6.
Yeah, that springs to mind particularly.
But these
you don't tend to get that situation unless you're marrying for alliance, for advantage, whereas if you're marrying the people you know, the people you meet, the people you're attracted to, then they're often going to be at least old enough to be at court and to be out in society.
Yeah, and to be accomplished enough to attract the king in the first place. I mean, he was a very intelligent man and interested in music and dancing and literature and all sorts. So, it took quite an accomplished woman, apart from perhaps Catherine Howard, to attract him really in the first place. I mean, Catherine Parr is the first woman to be public, the first English woman to publish under her own name, for example.
It is interesting how I think Anne of Cleves and Catherine Howard are such outliers in many ways to Henry's experience. Now, Anne of Cleves in the sense that he never met her, and Catherine Howard in the sense that it seems to be almost purely a physical attraction.
Yeah, absolutely. Catherine Howard is Henry's midlife crisis, I always think. He went out, now these days you could go and buy a sports car. He went and married a 15-year-old. She's a very off-the-wall choice, completely, completely wrong as queen. It's pretty clear that Catherine was guilty of the crimes that she was accused of. We know that she wasn't a virgin when she married Henry, that she had other lovers. Although she denied adultery of Thomas Culpeper, if it wasn't adultery, it was incredibly close. We know that she was guilty, but on the other hand, I always think really that it's Henry that's largely culpable for what happened, because he married this woman, this girl. She was hugely inexperienced in becoming a queen. She didn't know what she was doing, and really she was just totally inappropriate. So, yeah, she's definitely an outlier. And, of course, Anne of Cleves should have been the traditional choice of bride. It should have been that he married her, they got along okay, they had a couple of children, then he died and she was Queen Dowager. But, obviously, Henry had got used to picking his own brides by then, had other ideas. But again, she's quite unusual.
Okay, I'm going to move on now to possibly second hardest question that I'm going to ask you today. And that's, which do you think was the most successful? And of course, the main the main thing you need to do when you answer this question is define success.
Yes.
I remember my history essays. So I usually think of success in a queen as in terms of how many sons and children do they have, what did they bring to the marriage in terms of money, alliances, that sort of thing. How popular were they and how moral they were, which certainly in the Middle Ages tended to go hand in hand, and what kind of influence they brought to bear on the king. Although that wasn't always considered the most important thing at the time, it's sort of considered now the most important thing to us.
Yeah. I mean, if you'd asked Henry VIII who his most successful queen was, he would have said Jane Seymour, hands down. She's a woman that he chose to be buried with. She was the mother of his son. So she did everything that a queen is supposed to do in that period. She had a son. She was largely quite quiet and decorative, didn't seem to do very much. But having a son was absolutely crucial, and she did that. So she's the most successful. But I don't think that's a very satisfactory answer these days. And I don't think it's one that most people would accept, really. And particularly with hindsight, the fact that her son didn't go on to continue the dynasty, the answer might be different if Edward had lived to be 50 and had 7 sons, all of whom then had their own children. But obviously he didn't, he died at 15. So then we sort of have to think about what else is success. And you went through some areas that could be seen as success. I mean, partly success, given there were 6 wives, is in surviving Henry. Catherine Parr survived Henry, but not by very long. She died in childbirth the following year. But Anne of Cleves survived Henry by 10 years after he died. So, I mean, arguably she's the most successful. She's the last to die of the 6 wives, and she died having cemented her place in the English royal family. She last appeared in public in Queen Mary's coronation procession. So, I mean, arguably she's the most successful. Henry gave her a good pension when their marriage was annulled. And although inflation caused that to lose its value, she was still pretty comfortably off in her later years, and obviously didn't get her head chopped off. So arguably Anne of Cleves is one of the most successful, but obviously as a queen, she was the least successful. Their marriage wasn't even consummated. Henry couldn't stand her. So then you have to sort of look at the others. Catherine Parr, she comes across as quite successful. So modernised, she helped raise royal children, particularly Elizabeth. She survived Henry. She helped further the Protestant Reformation. She published it under her own name. But again, I mean, her life was very abruptly cut short by childbirth in 1548. So she didn't do nearly everything she wanted to. And I think Catherine Parr's, the popular perception of Catherine as a nursemaid isn't really what Catherine the woman was like. And actually her character is it's a lot more complex. So it's difficult to see her just as the mother to Henry's children, his stepmother, and this religious woman. There are many more facets to her character. Catherine of Aragon, if she'd had a son, she would have been incredibly successful. She was the archetypal medieval queen, really. The daughter of 2 monarchs, brought alliances. She was the aunt of the Holy Roman Emperor. Hugely successful in her day. In those respects, she was a great queen, was regent when Henry went to France and defeated the Scots at Flodden and killed the king. So hugely successful, but she didn't have a surviving son. Anne Boleyn, she was successful in winning the king. She was successful in giving birth to Elizabeth I, who's the greatest Tudor monarch, but she got her head chopped off, so that sort of discounts her as well. So it is quite difficult. If I had to plump for one, I think I'd have to go either with Jane Seymour, going with the contemporary definition, because it's difficult to escape that, or I think probably Catherine Parr, in that she was the queen that survived, and she was also regent, she raised the royal children. She was very much involved in religious reform. But it's a very, very tricky question.
Yeah, I think I'd gone on similar lines to you. I'd written down, I'd hedged my bets even more, and I went with 3. And I went with Catherine Parr, Jane Seymour. I also went with Catherine of Aragon, just because she lasted longer than everyone else combined, which I think can't be ignored.
No, she did. But she didn't give a king without sons an heir.
Yeah, which is the big the big problem. So I think she's the one. I think I said she ticked every box apart from the most important box.
Yeah, I agree. She's perfect. Whereas
Jane Seymour ticked only one box, but it was the most important one.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, a huge box to tick, the giving the king an heir when he didn't have brothers. You know, if he had a brother, then it would be a different story again, I think. But yeah, I agree. Catherine Aragon, the problem is the lack of the son. Otherwise, perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I do love a good queen in the medieval notion of it. I think it's also very difficult, I find, particularly with the medieval ones. You know, if you read the chronicles, they all talk about piety, and they all, you know, being a successful queen was all seen as being piety is so important to them. And I found it very difficult, because I use the four things I said to you, I use the ones I use internally to sort of judge them, and it's almost impossible to judge anyone other than, say, Catherine of Aragon on piety, because religious tradition is so in flux that one person's heretic is another person's prophet, almost.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. I mean, Catherine Parr was incredibly pious, but she was a Protestant, so she's certainly not in the same vein as Catherine of Aragon.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so moving on a little. Henry, obviously, had six wives, that's why we're here, and he had two of them killed, one of them semi-neglected to death, if we're being harsh. One died in childbirth, and two outlasted him. What do you think Henry's reaction was to the deaths of his wives? Obviously, they're varied ones, some involve wearing yellow clothing. Obviously, he's a very sort of impulsive person, so he often had people killed and then almost regretted it. What do you think Henry's reaction was to what happened with these women that he married?
So I think, I mean, you alluded to the death of Catherine of Aragon, where Henry celebrated the death wearing yellow. She obviously died 3 years after her marriage had been annulled, and she'd effectively been locked up and mistreated. Henry was not at all bothered that she died. He actually said that, God be praised, he was free from the threat of war, because obviously her nephew was the Holy Roman Emperor. So for him, it was a really good thing that Catherine had died, because it meant that the Emperor wasn't going to invade England and try and force him to take Catherine back. Anne Boleyn's death, there's a great deal of argument about how involved Henry was in the plot against Anne. I tend to view it that it's clear that she wasn't guilty of the charges. They don't stack up anyway. The actual specific charges, which give dates and places to her incest and her adultery, they're not correct. She wasn't staying in the places on all the occasions. It's pretty clear that they're trumped up charges to get rid of her. Some people lay the blame solely at Cromwell or in some of his co-conspirators, including Geoffrey. I think it's really impossible to bring down the Queen without the King's say-so, and I find it very hard to believe that he didn't know that they were trumped up. There's a comment by one of the ambassadors that says that he's the most cheerful cuckold he's ever seen, effectively. So Henry wasn't too concerned that Anne was going to the Tower. I think he knew that she was innocent. So because of that, I think we can safely say that Anne was in the way by being alive. And so Henry wasn't bothered by her death. He became engaged to Jane Seymour the day after her death, so he clearly wasn't particularly upset. Jane Seymour's death, on the other hand, Henry was very upset. She'd just given birth to their son. There's a reference where Cromwell is sent for to comfort the king because they don't think that Jane is going to survive the night when she's dying. At one stage, he says that he's going to leave Hampton Court the next day, whether the Queen amends or not. If she dies, if she gets better, then he wants to get away. And if she dies, he couldn't bear to stay there anyway if she doesn't get better. So it's pretty clear that he's upset about Jane's death. Why wouldn't he be, really? She's just giving him a son. That said, there's no evidence that his relationship with Jane is any particularly strong love match. She's not the love of his life like Anne Boleyn was. Anne of Cleves obviously outlived him. Catherine Howard when Henry heard about her adultery, he called for a sword to cut off her head himself. So I think we can be pretty clear he wanted rid of her. He could have got rid of her in a less bloody way. I mean, he could have had the marriage annulled based on a pre-contract with Francis Dearham. So saying that he'd effectively married Francis Dearham's wife would have got Catherine off the hook. But he wanted her dead. And then obviously Catherine Parr survived. So I think Jane Seymour is the only wife that Henry grieved for.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's true, and it speaks to a person who seems to find the people around him rather disposable. You sort of sometimes find with Henry, because he's such a big personality, sometimes you get sucked in, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of executions at Henry's court. Lots of people that Henry knew and liked, he had executed at some point. He was very changeable.
Again, further to this, I had a question from Wendy on the Facebook page, who asked whether the Queen's, I assume she's referring mainly to Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard, were they allowed to beg for forgiveness? I guess also it would be in the case of Catherine of Aragon, although she didn't really beg for forgiveness, she more begged for him to see sense.
They weren't going to get mercy, effectively. Anne Boleyn at first thought that she would be sent to a nunnery. She may have been promised that as a means to get her to cooperate with the annulment of her marriage, because Henry annulled their marriage 2 days before her death. But obviously he then had her executed anyway. So there's no evidence that she was given the chance to beg for mercy. She wanted to live, and the fact she thought she'd be sent to a nunnery, she wasn't accepting of her death, but there wasn't any way out. She was condemned to death and she died. Catherine Howard was hysterical when she was arrested, as Anne was as well. Catherine was obviously, it took a longer time between arrest and execution for Catherine. On the night before she died, she asked for the block to be brought to her room so that she could practice with it to ensure that she didn't disgrace herself. But by most accounts, she didn't say very much on the scaffold. She was too nervous and upset, effectively. So Catherine Howard wasn't given any opportunity to beg for mercy. She wasn't even given a trial. Anne Boleyn had a trial and at least didn't have a show of defending herself, even though it was largely a foregone conclusion. Catherine Howard was attainted by Parliament, so there was no trial for her. There was never going to be any way out for Catherine.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Tom, because Thomas Cromwell has a particularly tragic sort of letter begging for forgiveness as well. But I can't think of Catherine Howard definitely didn't one. I can't remember if Anne Boleyn wrote whether she wrote to him from the Tower. There is a letter, isn't there?
There is a letter. It's to the King and the Lady in the Tower. That's what it's ascribed on top by Cromwell's hands. It's amongst his papers. It looks a lot like a forgery. There's a lot of debate over it. I'm pretty dubious about it, I'm honest. She signs her name as Anne Boleyn and not as Anne the Queen, for example. And it's very accusatory and a very long letter. It would be a very not a sensible letter to write to a king who is going to have you executed regardless, and is in a position of power over your infant daughter and also your parents. And we know Anne was very close to her mother and also your surviving sister and all other relatives. It's not very sensible to write accusing the king effectively of murdering you when he's going to be in charge of your daughter and your family. So I think it's pretty unlikely that it's a genuine letter. It's possible, it's argued over. She's very clever on the scaffold and makes a very sort of acceptable speech. She asks people to pray for the king, and she says that he's a good prince and he's been a great prince to her. But it's kind of what she doesn't say. The most important point of her speech is she says that if anyone meddles in her cause, she asks them to judge the best, which effectively means I'm innocent as far as you can go in a scaffold speech. So, yeah, I would take Anne Boleyn's supposed letter from the Tower with a pinch of salt. I would look at her scaffold speech and also William Kingston's reports.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I found her scaffold speech very moving. I was a bit disappointed with Catherine Howard, because I'd always believed the wife of Culpeper story. And then when I did my research, I was very disappointed to find out that didn't happen. It was very sad.
it would be a great story. Actually, when they were arrested, Catherine Culpepper and Lady Rochford just blamed each other. It doesn't really look like it was a great romance, to be honest, Catherine and Culpepper. So they certainly turned on each other quite quickly. But it would be great. Yeah, they did. So it would be great if it was true. But actually, from what we know, it seems like she barely said anything, really. And was just terrified.
So the final listener question is from Diane, who wrote this as a comment on the website. And this is a very speculative question. And she asks, what would Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn think of their daughters' reigns if they were indeed looking down from heaven, or if they just had some sort of knowledge? What do you think they would have made of their respective daughters' reigns?
I think they both would have been incredibly proud, actually. It was Catherine of Aragon's dearest wish that her daughter would succeed Henry. She was the daughter of a female monarch, so she couldn't see any problem with a reigning queen. She raised Mary for queenship and wanted her to be queen after her. Mary was the focus of her life, and Henry, but Mary was what kept Catherine going. Actually, the pair were banned from seeing each other during the divorce, but they used to correspond. And so Catherine was always focused on Mary. I think she would have been very, very proud, firstly, that Mary won the crown. Secondly, that she attempted to bring back England's allegiance to Rome and also the traditional faith, which obviously was a huge thing in Catherine's life. Catherine was hugely pious. I don't think Catherine would necessarily had any concerns about the burnings. The burnings during Mary's reign were seen as a last resort and seen as saving these people's souls, effectively. So, you know, it's difficult to... You have to kind of look at them in a contemporary viewpoint. As far as Mary was concerned, it was the right thing to do to burn these Protestants. I should think the Protestants had other ideas. But so I think Catherine would have been very pleased. I think she would have been pleased that Mary married Philip of Spain, who was Catherine's great nephew. Obviously, she would have been disappointed that there wasn't an heir. But I can't see that Catherine would have been anything other than a proud mother, really. And with Anne Boleyn and Elizabeth, Anne surely would have been proud of Elizabeth. Elizabeth is the greatest Tudor monarch, one of the greatest monarchs England or Britain ever had. Presided over a very stable country. She did incredibly well. Anne Boleyn must have been proud of Elizabeth. And I think Elizabeth thought of her mother. We know that Elizabeth wore a ring, and when it was opened after her death, it was found to contain a portrait of both Elizabeth and Anne, which is a pretty clear evidence of what Elizabeth felt about her mother. Elizabeth's quite similar to Anne, a very intelligent woman, political, interested in religion. I think the pair would have got on, and Anne would have been nothing but proud.
I would definitely agree. I think the two things I wrote for this were proud they made it and proud of the religious convictions. I think making it is definitely that they you wouldn't have bet on either of them at almost any point after their mothers were killed or died. And it's interesting to see this sort of slow reintegration of them. It starts even with Jane Seymour, but it doesn't really take off for a long time. And obviously it's all down to Edward dying young and childless. But I think, yes, their survival, even getting to be queen, and, you know, and also they had to survive. Mary had to fight off Dudley and Lady Jane Grey and that. And then Elizabeth had to survive Mary as well, which she did barely. So I think I think pride is definitely the right word. That's annoying. I was hoping we would disagree on something. This is really irritating.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, they're almost their mothers in a subsequent generation, really, to be honest, which is, I think that's part of the problem between Mary and Elizabeth during Mary's reign, to be honest, because Mary was always actually quite kind to Elizabeth. After Anne's death, Mary slightly took her under her wing a little bit, so she would write to Henry and say she was a promising child and was nothing but kind to her. She always accepted she was her sister. Although later on there are rumours that Mary said that Elizabeth looked a bit like Mark Smeaton, who was one of Anne Boleyn's supposed lovers. But the relationship really deteriorated during Mary's reign, and I think it's largely because Elizabeth was so like her mother, really, and it was Mary hated Anne Boleyn and probably always hated her, I would think. She had no reason not to. So it must have been very difficult for Mary having this much younger half-sister whose birth had caused her so much pain and was the daughter of Anne Boleyn at her court. Not only that, but she was also much younger, much prettier and more intelligent, really.
I find Mary Tudor just such a fascinating woman, partly because she's been... You usually end up, I find, finding people fascinating when it turns out they're nothing like you were expected or nothing like you were taught, particularly like if you take their horrible history caricature. And, you know, Mary has been demonized thanks to, Protestants as being this, Bloody Mary, this murdering horror. And yet, actually, she seems to be just the most remarkable woman. And, yes, she did burn heretics, but Elizabeth burned heretics as well.
Or pressed them to death. Mary had a very difficult life for a royal princess. Her parents' divorce blighted her life, there's no doubt about it. She sided with her mother, which was, by contemporary standards, not the right thing to do. There's a letter from the Duke of Norfolk where he, to Henry, sort of, I think it's Henry, maybe addressed to Cromwell, but he's gone to see Mary or something, and she's so obstinate. He says that if she'd been his daughter, he would bash her head against a wall until it was as soft as a baked apple. And daughters were supposed to honour their parents, but particularly their father, and do what their father said. So if your father said, I was never married to your mother and you're illegitimate, actually you were supposed to say, oh, okay, sorry to hear that. And Mary didn't. So her relationship with Henry was very, very poor for a long time. She was sent to serve Elizabeth to emphasise the point that she was Henry's illegitimate daughter and not the legitimate princess. They were reconciled during Jane Seymour's reign, largely due to Jane Seymour, but the price of reconciliation was hugely high for Mary. She was effectively told that if she didn't sign a document confirming that her parents had never been married and that she was illegitimate, she would be executed. So she did sign it. Actually, the document survives and it's blotted with her tears, which shows the state she was in when she signed it. She never forgave herself for signing that document. When she became queen, she overturned her parents' annulment, so making herself once again legitimate. But so it was always on her mind. She had a very difficult time. I always think with Mary, she was very unlucky that she was 30 when Henry VIII died, whereas Elizabeth was much, much younger. So Mary, her youth was already passing, really, when Henry died, whereas Elizabeth still had her whole life ahead of her. So I think in that respect, Mary's sort of doubly unlucky, really, that by the time she became queen, she didn't have much time left.
Yeah, I would, again, once again, I would agree. And so let's try and have more of a fight here, because I'm on to the final question and the most contentious, which is who's your fave? And I'm going to be mean and make you go first.
Okay. This one's always tricky. I have two answers.
So I know it's very hard for you because you've written books on nearly
all of them. Yes, yeah. I have two. I have the one that's a more conventional choice, which is Catherine Parr. I like Catherine Parr. I think she's very interesting. Having done a lot more research on her for The Temptation of Elizabeth Tudor, which was a book about the Seymour scandal that I wrote that came out a couple of years ago, you see a different side to Catherine when you really delve in depth. So she always comes across as a bit matronly, very, very sort of honourable, takes on Elizabeth as her own daughter effectively, a very sort of pleasant, dedicated woman. After Henry's death, she married Thomas Seymour, who was the uncle of the new king, very quickly, shockingly quickly. He was later accused that he'd married Catherine so quickly that if she'd conceived a child, it would have been unclear whether it was Henry's or his. That was how soon they married. It was a very passionate but also quite violent relationship, effectively. We know that Thomas was called an oppressor in the household. There was one incident that was related by the servants that Catherine had been in a room and a male servant had come in to make up the fire, and the door was closed. And when Thomas discovered that, he basically accused Catherine of having an affair with this servant and caused a real scene in the household. He was diverting her funds to his own. Her officers were having to pay Thomas huge sums of money from her revenue. So it wasn't really a marriage of equals, effectively. I think she was quite under his thumb. Thomas was involved in a relationship with Elizabeth at the time. He was coming into her bed in the morning and tickling her and things, and Catherine colluded in that. She knew it was going on. So what I'm sort of getting at is a lot of this, it makes her seem more human, but it also makes her seem less sort of the perfect queen, if you like. She didn't protect Elizabeth. She was involved in this with this hugely unsuitable man, and politically she became very active and not necessarily for the right motives. Thomas and Catherine used Edward, the young Edward who looked upon Catherine as his mother, to their own ends on more than one occasion. So I do like Catherine Parr, but that puts me off a bit, although it makes her more human. So I would say, actually, my favourite wife is Anne of Cleves. I think she's fabulous. It's an unusual choice. I think she's great. Anne of Cleves is incredibly pragmatic. When she tried to make the most of her marriage, she tried her best. When it didn't work out, she was unhappy about the marriage coming to an end, but she accepted it for her pension and the payoff. So that's why she's my favourite, really. I think she's very pragmatic. I like her. She's a nice person.
I think in my episode on Anne of Cleves, I called I sort of described the kinds of people who choose each wife as their choice. And I think I called Anne of Cleves the hipster choice because it's very in vogue. It's quite in vogue at the moment. Especially from people who've read your books. She has that. I mean, for me, I guess I'm gonna, as many of my listeners know, I'm a strong medievalist at heart. We're getting further and further away from my my preferred era of the 12th century here, and the weird one whose favorite medieval queen is Matilda of Scotland. So for that reason, I say Catherine of Aragon, because she is so much a normal queen. You sort of separate the Henry VIII's six wives from like every other queen in English history because they seem to be in this weird micro culture, and yet Catherine of Aragon sort of stands out to me as this queen who did all the normal queeny things, and so many of them, because they only reigned for 1, 2, 3 years, they just didn't have that opportunity. I would say Catherine Parr is a close second because I see her as the second most normal queen.
Yes, yeah.
She has, although she didn't have children, she kind of didn't need to. That wasn't really the reason why she was married. And so she did bring up the children, and she has, she has influence. They both got to be regents, and I love queens who are regents.
Yes, yeah. Well, you like Matilda of Scotland, so.
She's not my favourite, but I have a strong soft spot for Catherine Howard. Maybe just I've only just covered her. But just because this isn't exactly true, this is more my mind, but she's what I think if you took your average 18-year-old, like from now, and sort of threw them in. The stories that come out of the places where she grew up at Chesham Hall and Lambeth are just magnificent. The stories of the men going down to raid the kitchens of grapes and wine and then bringing them up. And they had like this secret hiding place and all that stuff. And she sort of comes along and just seems to be having a whale of a time,
yeah.
Right up until the moment where she wasn't. All these other, there's so much colour in her life that you just don't have in other ones who live in these sort of rigid, this is how you act, this is how a queen is, this is what a lady does. And Catherine just brushes past all of it. And of course it cost her head. I have a strong soft spot for Catherine Howard.
Yeah, no, I think she's interesting. I like Catherine Howard. But no, I'm an Anne of Cleves person.
I do know that neither of us are Anne Boleyn people.
No, I know, I do like Anne Boleyn. I think she's interesting, but I think she's a flawed individual. And I don't think that makes her more human.
Thanks very much for coming on. It's been a wonderful chat. I was wondering if there's anything you wanted to plug. What are you up to at the moment? Are you working on any new books?
Well, The main one is My Lives of Tudor Women, which came out in the UK at the end of last year, and it's coming out in the US in a couple of weeks, and it's The Hidden Lives of Tudor Women. So if anyone would like to buy that, that would be great. It's basically, it's an account of the life of a Tudor woman from every level of society and sort of looking at what daily life was like. So it's quite a good read, quite interesting. I loved researching it.
So that is all for this week. I want to thank Elizabeth Norton for coming on the... You didn't think I'd leave you hanging like that, did you? You'll want to know who you have chosen as the Queens of England podcast listener's favourite wife of Henry VIII. To coincide with the recent TV series by Lucy Worsley on Six Wives, Tudor Times did its own survey of historians and historical writers on whom their favourite was. Heather Tesco sided with Elizabeth and chose Anne of Cleves, as did Tracy Borman. Alison Weir is in my corner in choosing Catherine of Aragon. Sarah Griswood chose Anne Boleyn, and Linda Porter chose Catherine Parr. But who did you choose? Well, we had nearly 200 votes in all, and I will reveal them in reverse order. In last place, with just 3 votes, is Catherine Howard. Selene Jones chose her because, quote, "I pity that girl for having to get in bed with the 50-plus-year-old Henry VIII. Next, with 9 votes, is Henry's favourite, Jane Seymour. Grace Carruth gave her vote because, quote, "though she does not have the most scandalous or immediately intriguing story, her gentle courage is impressive, as is her astute embracing of a traditional queenly role within the tense court atmosphere she inherited." After her comes Catherine Parr with 18 votes, possibly suffering because I hadn't finished covering her by the time the poll was done. That didn't put off Julia Rang, who chose her because she was, quote, "a great intellectual and lover of the arts, and the first woman to publish under her own name. Enough said. I also really enjoyed how the latest episode brought out her light-hearted side and love of fine things. Plus, I have a great respect for good stepmothers." And yes, praising me is always going to make your message more likely to be noticed by me. Moving now into the top 3, with 29 votes, we have Anne of Cleves. Jeanette Morrison said, quote, "definitely Anne of Cleves. Despite being the victim of the worst blind date in world history, she remained good-natured, calm, and pragmatic." Okay, so it's serious now. In second place, with 37 extremely intelligently cast votes, we have, drumroll please, kind of unnecessary because I've already given it away, Catherine of Aragon. She was also the choice of my in-laws, by the by. After comparing Henry to Donald Trump, Amber Engleby goes on to say that she voted for Catherine because, quote, "she proved herself as a capable and competent leader while Henry was in France, in addition to fulfilling the more traditional queenly duties, save for that one. This series cast her in a new light for me. I enjoyed learning just how strong-willed that she was, and I admire her refusal to simply roll over to Henry's demands. I also admire her perseverance through the mistreatment she suffered from her own father's careless neglect, Henry VII's miserliness, her nephew's betrayals, and her husband's general douchebaggery." And so, our runaway wither, with 87 votes, that's 47.5% of them all, is Anne Boleyn. Obviously, there were many commenters who picked Anne. Here are a few. Tiffany Reyes identified with Anne. Quote, "she is the founding member of the Second Wives Club. As with most second wives, she is portrayed as a young tart with only marriage on the brain for money and power. There is so much more to us second wives." Carly Eck, who apparently has a Anne Boleyn tattoo, location unconfirmed, wrote that she loves Anne Boleyn because she was, quote, "smart as hell and demonized into oblivion. She's overlooked in a lot of ways because of the way she died. She was passionately evangelical and very pious, gave large amounts of money to charity, and obviously incredibly intelligent in the way she played the Game of Thrones, for what little control women generally had over such matters." And last, but by no means least, Susan Laster Millsap, who commented quite late on, chose, quote, "Anne Boleyn, for many of the reasons already listed, but specifically her intellect, passion, and strength. She stood firm to her goals and held her head high." So, there we are. Anne Boleyn is your favourite. You all have terrible taste. Just kidding. As I said at the top of the show, next week we start our mini-series of supplementals on the men in the lives of Mary I and Elizabeth I as we conclude our coverage of the Tudors. There are broken hearts, royal weddings, swashbuckling heroes, and a decent dollop of treason to come. So I hope to see you there.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.